They all woke from dreams of wet black wings. And there was more. The nights should have grown lighter by now. There should be snowdrops in the garden. Their mother should not still have a cough that woke her at night. There should be birdsong in the mornings. They should not still shiver in their beds. And it was all because of something they'd done and forgotten and never repented, or was because the Essex earthquake had let something loose in the black water. Or perhaps it was because their father had lied. "He said he's not afraid, and there's nothing there. But why won't he go down to the sea after dark any more? Why won't he let us play out on the boats? Why does he look tired?" Whatever the cause, and wherever the blame, they were going to do something about it. Long ago, in other lands, they'd cut out hearts to bring the sun up. Surely it wasn't too much to ask that they try out a little spell for the sake of the village. "I have it all worked out," she said. "You trust me, don't you?" They stood between the ribs of a clipper, which had pitched up there a decade ago and never shifted from the shore. In the harshness of the weather, it had worn down to little more than a dozen black curved posts that looked so much like the opened chest cavity of a drowned beast that visitors took to calling it Leviathan. It was near enough to the village for the children to reach it without censure, and far enough out of sight for no one to notice what they did there. In summer, they hung their clothes from its bones, and in winter they lit small fires in its shelter, always afraid the hulk would burn, and dismayed when it didn't. Love notes and curses were cut in the wood with penknives. Pennies were stacked on the posts and were never spent. Joanna's little fire was set some distance away from the wreck in a circle of stones and had taken hold nicely. She looped it with lengths of bladderwrack, which gave off a clean scent, and pressed into the coarse sand seven of her best shells.
"I'm hungry."
John looked up at his sister and immediately regretted his lack of resolve. He'd turned seven before summer and felt firmly that it was high time he matched his increasing years with increasing courage.
"I don't mind, though," he said,
and capered twice around the fire.
"We have to be hungry, because tonight's the night of the hunger moon. Isn't that right, Joe?"
Red-haired Naomi Banks crouched with her back to Leviathan and looked beseechingly at her friend. As far as she was concerned, Reverend Ransom's daughter had the Queen's authority and God's wisdom, and she'd cheerfully have stepped barefoot in the flames if the other girl had commanded it.
"That's right, the hunger moon, and the last full moon before spring."
Conscious of the need to be both stern and benevolent, Joanna imagined her father in his pulpit and mimicked his stance. In the absence of a lectern, she raised both her arms and said in a chanting voice, which had taken some weeks to perfect,
"We are gathered here on the day of the hunger moon to beseech Persephone to break the chains of Hades and bring spring to our beloved land."
Wondering if she'd struck quite the right note, and a little concerned that she was playing fast and loose with the education her father insisted upon, she glanced quickly at Naomi. Her friend's cheek was flushed, and her eyes were bright. She pressed a hand to her throat, and Joanna, bolstered, went on.
"Too long have we suffered, winter winds. Too long have the dark nights concealed the river's terrors."
John, whose determination to be brave was unequal to his dread of the beast, probably lurking not 100 yards away in the water, squealed. His sister frowned and raised her voice a little.
"Goddess Persephone, hear us!"
She nodded briskly at her companions, who chorused.
"Goddess Persephone, hear us!"
They made their supplications to numerous gods, genuflecting deeply at each name. Naomi, whose mother had been of the old religion, crossed herself fervently.
"And now," said Joanna, "we have to make a sacrifice."
And John, who'd never forgotten the story of how Abraham had tethered his son to an altar and got out his carving knife, squealed again and bolted twice round the fire.
"Come back, stupid boy," said Joanna. "Nobody's going to hurt you." "The Essex serpent might," said Naomi, coming at the child with claws and receiving a look of such censure in return that she flushed and took John's hand in hers.
"We give you the sacrifice of our hunger," said Joanna,
whose stomach burbled shamefully. She'd concealed breakfast in a napkin and fed it later to the dog, and pleading a headache, avoided lunch.
"We give you the sacrifice of our cold."
Theatrical, Naomi shivered.
"We give you the sacrifice of our burning. We give you the sacrifice of our names."
Joanna paused, forgetting for a moment the ritual she'd prepared. Then, putting her hand in her pocket, took out 3 pieces of paper. Earlier that day, she dipped the corner of each sheet in the font of her father's church, alert to the possibility he'd find her there, and with several lies prepared in her defence. The damp corners had dried in ripples, and as she handed them to her fellow celebrants, they crackled audibly.
"It is necessary for us to commit to the spells," she said somberly, "to give a part of our own nature. We must write our names, and in writing them, vow to whichever gods hear us that we give of our own being, in the hope that winter will be gone from the village."
She examined her words as she said them, and, pleased with her phrasing, was struck by a new thought. Stooping to pick up a broken twig, she put it in the fire and let it burn a while, then, blowing out the flame, scrawled her name on the paper with the charcoal. It was not quite extinguished, and the paper scorched and tore, and the goddesses would need celestial vision to make out more than her initials from so great a distance, but the effect was gratifying. She handed the stick to Naomi, who scored her paper with a capital N, and helped James make his mark. The boy was proud of his handwriting and scuffled and elbowed at the girl, determined to manage on his own.
"Now," said Joanna,
collecting up the pieces of paper and tearing them into fragments,
"come to the fire with me. Are your hands cold? Are they full of winter?"
"Full of winter," she thought. "What a line." Perhaps she'd be a vicar like her father when she grew up. John looked at the tips of his fingers and wondered whether he might soon see the first black flecks of frostbite.
"I can't feel anything."
"Oh, you will,"
said Naomi, grinning. Her hair was red, and so was her coat, and John had never liked her.
"You'll feel something, all right."
She tugged him to his feet, and they joined Joanna by the flames. Someone stood on a string of bladderwrack and made it pop, and some distance away the tide was turning.
"Now," said Joanna, "you're going to have to be brave, John, because this is going to hurt."
She tossed the scraps of paper into the fire and followed them with a scattering of salt from her mother's silver shaker. The flames burned briefly blue. Then, holding out her hands to the fire with an imperious nod that her companions should do the same, she closed her eyes and held them, palm down, above the fire. A damp log spat sparks and scorched her father's sleeve. She flinched and, fretting for the white skin on her brother's wrist, tugged his hands upward an inch or more.
"We don't have to hurt ourselves badly," she said hastily. "We just have to let our hands warm up quickly, and it'll burn like it does when you come in from the snow."
Naomi, chewing a coil of hair, said,
"Look! You can see my veins!"
And it was true. She had a little webbing of flesh set deep between each of her fingers, and was proud of her defect, having once heard that Anne Boleyn had had something similar and caught herself a king, nonetheless. In the firelight, a ruddy glow passed through the thin flesh and threw into blue relief a vein or two. Joanna, impressed, but conscious of the need to maintain the upper hand, said,
"We have come here to mortify our flesh, Nomi, not take pride in it."
She used the nickname of their babyhood to show that the girl was not in disgrace, and in response, Naomi flexed her fingers and said very seriously,
"Oh, it really hurts. I can tell you that. It's prickling like nettles."
The girls looked at John, whose hands wavered with his courage. Something was evidently going on, since his fingers were a vivid red, and even, Joanna thought, swollen at the tips. Either the low-hanging smoke the fire gave out had stung his eyes, or he was trying not to cry. Torn between her certainty that the gods would look kindly on the sacrifice from so small a celebrant, and equal certainty that her mother would be justifiably outraged, she nudged the boy and said,
"Hiya, silly boy, hiya! Do you want to burn yourself to stumps?"
At this, his held-back tears overspilled, and just at that moment, or so Joanna later told it, huddled under a school table with Naomi nodding at her side and an audience awestruck at her feet, the full moon passed out of a low blue cloud. All around them, the pebble-specked sand took on a sickly cast, and the sea, creeping at them over the salt marsh as their backs were turned, glistened.
"A sign! You see?"
said Joanna, removing her hands from above the fire, then hastily replacing them at Naomi's raised eyebrow.
"A portent! It is the goddess!"
She cast about for the name.
"The goddess Phoebe, come to acknowledge our petition."
John and Naomi turned towards the moon and looked a long while on its downcast face. Each of them saw, in the high mottled disk, the melancholy eyes and curved mouth of a woman, sunk in sadness.
"Do you think it worked?"
Naomi could not believe that her friend might have been mistaken in so serious a matter as the summoning of spring, and besides, she'd felt the pain in her hands, and she had not eaten since bread and cheese the night before. And had she not also seen her own name on its christened piece of paper go up in a shower of sparks? She buttoned her coat a little higher and looked out over the salt marsh and the sea, half expecting to see an early sunrise, and with it a flock of swifts.
"Oh, Nomi, I don't know."
Kicking aimlessly at the sand, Joanna found herself already a little ashamed of her display. All that waving of her arms about and chanting. Really, she was much too old for all this.
"Don't ask me,"
she said, forestalling further query.
"Not done it before, have I?"
Pricked with guilt, she knelt beside her brother and said gruffly,
"You were very brave. If it doesn't work, it won't be your fault."
"I want to go home. We'll be late, and there'll be trouble, and there won't be dinner left, and it was going to be my favourite."
"We won't be late," said Joanna. We said we'd be home before dark, and it's not dark, is it? It's not dark yet. But it was almost dark, and it seemed to be coming, she thought, from across the sea, beyond the estuary, which had taken on the appearance of a black and solid substance across which she might walk, if she cared to try. She'd lived all her life here, at the margin of the world, and never once thought to mistrust its changing territory. The seeping of salt water up through the marshes, and the changing patterns of its muddy banks and creeks, and the estuary tides, which she checked almost daily against her father's almanac, were all as untroublesome as the patterns of her family life. Before she could ever have recognised them on paper, she could sit on her father's shoulders and point and proudly name Foulness and Point Clear. St. Osyth and Mercia, and the direction of St. Peter's on the wall. It was a family trick to spin her a dozen times and say, "She'll always come out facing east, to the mouth of the sea." But something had changed in the course of their ritual. She had a curious impulse to glance backward over her shoulder, as if she might catch out the tide in reversing its direction, or see the waters split open as once they had for Moses. She'd heard, of course, the rumours that something lived now in the estuary depths, and was responsible for the taking of a lamb and the breaking of a limb, but thought little of it. Childhood was so rife with terrors that it was useless giving more credence to one thing than to another. Wanting to see again the sad, pale face of the lady in the moon, she looked up, and there was only the gathering of dense clouds stacking up above the marsh. The wind had dropped, as it often did at dusk, and up on the road above them the earth would be hardening with frost. John, evidently feeling his own unease, forgot his increasing years and put his hand in hers, and even Naomi, who'd never once been seen to look afraid, sucked fretfully at her coil of hair and drew closer to her friends. As they made their silent way past the dying embers of their fire, and past Leviathan as it shored itself deeper for the night, they glanced repeatedly over their shoulders at the black water creeping closer across the mud.
"Girls and boys come out to play," sang Naomi,
not quite managing to keep a tremor from her voice.
"The moon doth shine as bright as day."
Much later, and only when pressed, since it had all seemed to be part of a ritual of which the children felt strangely ashamed, each claimed to have seen a curious thickening and rising of the water in a particular place, just where the salt marsh ended and the river bed shelved steeply down. There'd be no sound, and nothing as comfortingly frightening as a long limb or rolling eye. Only a movement that was too swift and directionless to be the casting of a wave. John claimed that it had had about it a whitish look, but Joanna thought that was only the moon peering out and brightening the surface with her gaze. Naomi, the first to speak up, embellished the event with such a flourish of wing and snout that it was generally accepted she'd seen nothing at all, and her testimony was discarded.
"How long until we're home, Jojo?"
John, tense with a longing to run home to his mother and the dinner he imagined going cold on the table, tugged at his sister's hand.
"Nearly there. Look! See the smoke from the chimneys and the sails on the boats?"
They had reached the path, their teeth chattering with the sudden chill and with unease, and up ahead the oil lamps set in the windows of the world's end had the charm of a Christmas tree. They could see Cracknell making his rounds for the night, cuffing Gog and Magog into their pen, and pausing at the gate to bid them good night.
"Girls and boys come out to play," he sang, having heard them coming, thudding the gatepost for emphasis. and though I note it's a full-face moon, you'll have no daybright shining, what with the light being borrowed only, and that paid back at interest, and losing its value month by month, which accounts for the dimness of the thing. Eh?
Pleased with this line of thought, he grinned, then beckoned them closer, and closer still, so that they smelt the earthy dampness rising from the pockets of his coat and saw the stripped bodies of the moles hanging by their heels.
"Keen to get home, ain't he?"
Cracknell nodded at John, who was an old friend of his, and would not usually pass up the chance to sit astride Gog or Magog, and circuit the shack, and Arthur eat honey straight from the comb. John, who by now imagined his supper being passed to the dog, scowled, and it was perhaps this that made the old man scowl in return and grasp the boy's ear.
"Listen up, then, the three of you. It's not just girls and boys come out to play in these times, which I do wonder, but might well be the last. And you'll hear no regrets from me on that score. Even so, come quickly, Lord Jesus, as I might have said when I had truck with such talk. Join your playfellows in the street, as the song says. But it's a strange playfellow you made down there in the Blackwater, Blackwater. Don't think I don't know, and haven't seen it myself twice or thrice when the moon's bright."
He gripped John's ear a little too tight, and the boy yelped. Cracknell looked at his own hand in surprise, as if it had operated without his permission, and released John, who rubbed his face and began to cry.
Well then, what's this noise for?"
Cracknell patted his several pockets, but found nothing that might placate a child in need of his mother's lap and a hot meal.
"I only speak kindly, only kindly, as always, I hope I do. Wouldn't wish the snapping and the creeping and the watching on any of you or any of yours."
John had not yet stopped crying, and Joanna feared for a moment that the old man might cry also out of shame and something she suspected was fear. She reached over the mole-strung fence and patted the greasy sleeve of his coat twice, and had begun to cast about for something soothing to say when Cracknell stiffened, thrust up his arm, and roared,
"Halt now! What goes there?"
The children flinched. John buried his face in his sister's waist. Naomi spun on her heel and gasped. A dark, misshapen creature was coming at them along the path, moving slowly, making a low sound in the depths of its throat. It did not creep, but stood on hind legs. It almost had the shape of a man. It held out its arms. It might have been a threat, but the noise it made seemed almost laughter. It was a man. Surely. Indeed, there was something in the unhurried gait that was almost familiar. Nearer it came to the light cast by Cracknell's lamps. It paused, and she saw its long coat shedding thick flakes of mud and its heavy boots. The face was obscured by a hat pulled low to the brows and by a heavy scarf. Everything about the creature was coated in mud that showed black with damp in places and dried pale in others. Only there were parts of the filthy hat which showed the original scarlet of the wool.
"Don't you know me? Am I such a sight?"
Again the man held out his arms, then tugged off the knitted cap, and a thicket of untidy curls, the same russet shade as her own long plait, gleamed in the lamplight.
"Daddy! Where have you been? What have you done? How have you cut your cheek?"
"John, lad, And don't you know your own father?
With a child in the crook of each arm, the Reverend William Ransom reached out to cuff Naomi kindly on the shoulder and nodded at Cracknell, who said,
"And a sight for sore eyes you represent as ever, parson. And if I could suggest the little uns be taken home and kept there, I'll bid each a good night."
Bowing to them all, and most deeply to John, the old man retreated into World's End and slammed shut the door.
"And why are you all out so late,
might I ask?"
"We shall all of us answer to your mother for this. And as for you, Miss Banks, what will I tell your father?"
He tweaked Naomi's cheek and propelled her home towards a grey stone cottage that overlooked the quay. The girl looked once over her shoulder at her friends, then hurried inside, and they heard the door bolted.
"Yes, but, Daddy, where have you been? What have you done to your face? Do you need a stitch?"
This said eagerly, since Joanna had a private longing to wield the surgeon's knife.
"Never mind that. Why is John crying? And he's as old as the hills."
Will tightened his hold on the boy, who swallowed the last of his sobs.
"As for me, I've been out rescuing sheep and frightening ladies. And I must say..."
They'd reached the checkered garden path and the borders where snowdrops gleamed in the dark.
"That I haven't enjoyed myself so much in a long time." "Stella, we're home and we need you."
March. Stella Ransom, All Saints Rectory, Oldwinter, 11th of March.
"My dear Mrs. Seaborn, I write in the hope that a note from me won't seem a note from a stranger, since Charles Ambrose assures me you're expecting to hear from the Ransom family of Oldwinter, Essex. And behold, here we are. But first, I hope you will accept the most sincere condolences from my husband and myself on your recent bereavement. We hear little of London, and yet Mr. Seaborn's name reached us via Charles, and sometimes even in the Times. We know him to have been a man greatly admired, and I'm sure greatly loved. You have been in our prayers, and most of all mine, as I think I can imagine best a wife's grief at her husband's loss. And now, to the matter at hand. Charles and Catherine Ambrose will be here next Saturday for supper, and we would be delighted beyond measure if you would join us. I understand you are accompanied by your son, and by a companion of whom Charles speaks very fondly, and we would be pleased to meet them also. There is no occasion to be marked, only the chance to see old friends and make new ones. Our address is as you see it, and we are easily reached from Colchester. I'm afraid there's no train, but it's a pleasant enough journey by cab. You must stay with us, of course. We have room, and you will not want to travel home so late. I will wait your response, and in the meantime, plan what dainty dishes I can set before a woman with London tastes. Yours very sincerely, Stella Ransom. P.S. As you see, I could not resist sending you a primrose, though I was too impatient to press it well, and it has stained the page. I never could learn to bide my time. S.
Chapter 1. Dr. Luke Garrett surveyed his room at the George Hotel, Colchester, with grudging pleasure. It was clear that Spencer had spared no expense. His fingertip, having been swept across each surface, remained spotless.
"I could perform an appendectomy in here," Luke said,
with what his friend rightly took to be an air of wishing disease on passers-by. The cleanliness of the room established, Garrett flicked open the brass fastenings of his suitcase and withdrew a pair of crumpled shirts, several books with pages folded down, and a sheaf of paper. This he set on the dressing table, reverently surmounted with a white envelope on which his name was written in a neat, decisive hand.
"She's expecting us?"
Spencer nodded at the envelope. He knew Cora's handwriting well, since his friend had lately been in the habit of passing him each of her letters, the better to examine the meaning behind each phrase.
"Expecting? Expecting? I wouldn't have come. Left to my own devices, I've far too much to do. Not to put too fine a point on it, Spencer, the woman begged. 'I miss you, dear,' she said."
He gave his wolfish grin, and above it his black eyes shone.
"I miss you, dear."
"Will we see her tonight?" Spencer said this carelessly. He had motives of his own for this display of impatience, but having successfully concealed them, even from Garrett's forensic gaze, was unwilling to show them. Too absorbed in re-reading Cora's letter, mouthing "dear" to himself twice, his friend noticed nothing, only said,
"Yes, they're at the Red Lion. We'll see them at 8. At 8 on the dot, if I know Cora, which I do."
"Then I will go for a walk. It's too fine a day to be cooped up. And I want to see the castle. They say you can still see ruins from the Essex earthquake. Will you come?"
"Certainly not. I hate walking. Besides, I have here a report of a Scottish surgeon who is convinced he can relieve paralysis by the exertion of pressure on the spinal column. I think often, you know, that I would have been better off in Edinburgh than in London. There is such courage there among medical men, and the miserable climate suits me."
Spencer and the castle already forgotten, Garrett sat cross-legged on the bed and spread before him a dozen sheets of fine black type punctuated with drawings of vertebrae. Spencer, a little relieved to be granted an afternoon's solitude, buttoned up his coat and left. The George Hotel was a fine white inn that overlooked the broad high street. The proprietors plainly fancied their position as the best establishment in town and displayed these credentials by means of a thicket of hanging baskets in which daffodils and primroses jostled bad-temperedly for space. The day was fine, as if the sky regretted the slow release of winter's grip. The high clouds hurried on to pressing business in another town. Ahead, the spire of St. Nicholas glittered, and there was a great deal of birdsong. Spencer, who could differentiate between a sparrow and a magpie only if pressed, found himself bewildered and delighted by it, and by the whole merry town with bright striped awnings above the pavements and cherry blossoms speckling the sleeve of his coat. When he encountered a ruined house and, at its threshold, a crippled man seated like a sentinel off guard, this too seemed to him a charming sight. The house displayed an interior gone over to ivy and saplings of oak, and the cripple had taken off his coat to bask like a cat in eddies of light. The embarrassment of his riches made Spencer absurdly generous, and wanting to share a little of the day's joy, he emptied his pockets into the man's upturned hat. The weight of the coins dented the shabby felt. The man raised it level with his eyes, peering as if suspecting a practical joke. Then, evidently satisfied, bared a row of superb teeth in a grin.
"Looks like I can knock off for the day then, don't it?"
He reached behind his stone perch for a low wooden trolley on four iron wheels, and with a practised movement swung himself into it and drawing on a pair of leather gauntlets to protect his palms, propelled himself deftly towards the pavement. The trolley, Spencer saw, was extremely well made, with designs of knotwork cut into it. A Celtic warrior felled in battle might have been content with such a vehicle, so that whatever natural pity he might have felt for the man's infirmity seemed an affront.
"Fancy a look, then?"
With a lift of his chin, the man indicated the gaping ruin of the house behind, conveying the impression that he held authority over its broken walls.
"Worst of the earthquake, this, and a danger to life and limb, if you ask me, which no one ever does. But there's such a wrangling in the law courts. They can't settle who's to foot the bill. And meanwhile, there's barn owls in the dining room."
Negotiating a pair of fallen marble slabs on which the remains of Roman lettering were gathering moss, the man led Spencer to the threshold of the house. Much of the front wall had sheared away, leaving the rooms and staircases exposed. Nothing was left but what could not be reached or looted. The lower floors were empty, save for immense carpets in which violets had seeded themselves and grew dense as a mattress concealing coy blue flowers. On the upper levels, paintings and trinkets remained. Something silver glinted on the windowsill, and at the head of the staircase, a chandelier's crystal drops might have been polished that morning for the night's events.
"Quite a sight, isn't it? Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, and what have you." "You ought really to sell tickets at the door," said Spencer, hoping to spot the barn owl. "Surely every passer-by wants a look."
"They do, Mr. Spencer, but they are not always given it."
This voice was not a man's, soft with Essex vowels and coming from below, but was that of a woman, and a London one at that. Spencer would have known it anywhere, and when he turned away from the ruin he knew he was blushing, but could not prevent it.
"Martha, you are here."
"And so I see are you. And you've met my old friend."
Martha reached down, smiling, and grasped the cripple's hand. He shook it, and shook also his well-filled hat.
"Enough here for a leg or two, I reckon."
Then, with a gesture of farewell, began to wheel himself home.
"There is no barn owl. He only says it to please the tourists."
"Well, it certainly pleased me."
"Everything pleases you, Spencer."
She wore a blue jacket, and over her shoulder hung a leather bag from which protruded several peacock's feathers. In her left hand she held a white magazine, and on it Spencer saw "An English Woman's Review of Social and Industrial Questions," printed in elaborate black type. Trying his hand at gallantry, he said,
"Well, seeing you pleases me, at least."
But of all women, Martha was the last to approve such a ploy. She raised an eyebrow, and rolling up the magazine, struck him on the arm.
"Enough of all that. Come and see Cora. She'll be so glad you came. The imp is with you, I suppose?"
"He is reading up on paralysis and what to do about it. But he'll join us later."
"Good. I want to speak to you about something."
She shook the magazine.
"And it is impossible to be serious about anything with that man in the room. How was the journey?"
"A child cried from Liverpool Street to Chelmsford, and only stopped when Garrett told him he'd lose all the water from his body, shrivel up, and be dead by Manningtree."
Martha snorted.
"How either you or Cora can stand his company is a mystery to me. Is this your hotel?"
She surveyed the pale facade of the George and its hanging baskets.
"We're at the Red Lion, a little further on. I didn't think we'd stay so long, only Francis has taken a liking to the landlord, and so life has been calm of late. Feathers are the latest fad.
You'd think he was trying to make himself a pair of wings, though there's not much angelic about that boy.
And Cora, is she well?
I've never known her happier, though sometimes she remembers she ought not to be, and puts on her black dress and sits in the window looking like an artist's idea of grief.
They passed a flower seller closing her stall for the night and selling daffodils by the armful for a penny. Retrieving the last coin or two from his pockets, Spencer relieved her of her stock and, clasping a dozen bunches of the yellow blooms, said,
"Let's take spring to Cora. We'll fill up her rooms and she'll forget she was ever sad about anything."
He glanced quickly at his companion, afraid he'd spoken out of turn. Perhaps it was best to keep up the pretense of a decent woman decently mourning. But Martha said, smiling, "She'll thank you for it too. All month she's been going out walking, looking for signs of spring, and coming home muddy and bad-tempered. Then one day, there it was, on the stroke of noon, as if someone had summoned it."
"And has Essex yielded any fossils? I saw in the papers some new species was unearthed up on the Norfolk coast after a winter storm. Sometimes I think we must be walking on shoals of bodies without realizing it, and all the earth's a graveyard."
Spencer, who rarely voiced his flights of whimsy, flushed a little and prepared for one of Martha's parries, but none came.
"A toadstone or two," she says, "but nothing more. But she has high hopes for the Essex serpent. Look, here we are."
A little distance on, Spencer saw a timber-framed inn from which hung an iron sign emblazoned with a red lion rampant.
"The Essex serpent?" said Spencer, glancing down as if expecting to see an adder on the pavement. "It's all she talks about these days. Didn't she write to the imp and tell him?
Some legend kept going by village idiots about a winged snake seen coming out of the estuary and menacing villages on the coast.
She's got it into her head. It's one of these dinosaurs they say might have survived extinction.
Did you ever hear the like?"
They'd reached the threshold of the inn and saw through its thick, mottled panes of glass a fire in the hearth. There was a strong scent of spilled beer and a joint roasting somewhere out of sight.
"What can you expect of poor country folk who can't read or write?"
Her Londoner's contempt was magnificent, taking in the spire of St. Nicholas and the paltriness of the earthquake and the Red Lion and everyone in it.
"But Cora has a hive of bees in her bonnet. She says it's likely a living fossil.
She would tell you the names for them. I can never remember.
And she's determined to seek it out."
"Garrett always says she'll not rest easy until her name's on the wall in the British Museum," said Spencer. "I can believe it might happen, too."
At the doctor's name, Martha snorted and pushed open the door.
"Come up to our rooms and see Francis. He'll remember you and won't mind your coming."
Luke, arriving late, having attempted to replicate a human vertebrae in papier-mâché, found his friends seated on a thinning rug, their clothes studded all over with feathers. In a window seat, Martha turned the pages of a magazine and watched Francis silently threading feathers from gulls and crows through the weave of Spencer's coat until he looked like an angel dismayed by its fall. Cora had come off relatively lightly, with a peacock plume sticking up from the back of her dress and the contents of a pillow dusting her shoulders. No one noticed the imp arrive, so that he turned and re-entered noisily.
"What is going on? Have I come to the insane asylum? Where are my wings, then, or must I be earthbound? Cora, I have brought you books. Spencer, get me something to drink. You have something on your coat.
Cora, giving a little yell of delight, leaped up and kissed the newcomer on each cheek, holding him at arm's length.
You've come. Have you grown?
Half an inch at...
No, that was cruel. I'm sorry. Only you're late, you know. Frankie, say hello.
Francis has a new hobby, as you see, and we're all being very patient about it.
You remember Luke?
The boy did not look up, but sensing a change of air to which he had not agreed, began silently to retrieve each fallen feather from the carpet, counting in reverse.
376, 375, 374.
Now our play is ended, said Cora ruefully. Though he'll be quiet enough now so long as he reaches one...
You look dreadful, said Luke,
who would have liked to touch one by one the freckles newly arrived on her forehead.
Don't you brush your hair out in the sticks? Your hands are dirty. And what are you wearing?
I freed myself from the obligation to try and be beautiful, said Cora. And I was never more happy. I can't remember when I last looked in the mirror.
Yesterday, said Martha, you were admiring your nose.
Good evening, Dr. Garrett.
This was said with so penetrating a chill, Luke shivered, and might have attempted a wounding response if the landlord had not arrived, and, with an admirable refusal to acknowledge the feather-strewn room and the chanting boy, left a tray of beer upon the sideboard. This was followed by a platter of cheese and cold beef marbled with yellow fat, and a plaited white loaf, and a dish of pale butter sprinkled with salt, and lastly a cake, studded with cherries and giving off the scent of brandy. And such was the impossibility of maintaining a bad temper in the presence of the feast that Luke gave Martha the sweetest smile he could manage and tossed her a green apple. Spencer, sitting beside Martha on the window seat to watch the passers-by on the wet black pavements below, took up her magazine and said,
You were going to tell me about this. May I see what you've been reading?
He leafed through the booklet, which contained bewildering statistics on London's overpopulation and the catastrophic consequences of urban clearance. Martha surveyed him with the temporary warmth of wine. Truth be told, he roused in her a kind of reflexive loathing which took an effort to suppress. Certainly he seemed kindly enough and gentle. She'd seen him make attempts with Francis no other visitor had ever done, all those swift games of chess ending in Spencer's defeat. And she admired his efforts to keep the imp in check. More, and most importantly, he treated Cora with a courteous friendship which never once transgressed into attempts to know her any better than he ought. But she saw his wealth and privilege coat him like furs. What little she knew of his circumstances, the possession of more property than he could find useful, the liberty to train in medicine as a kind of hobby, while women contented themselves with bedpans and broth, ranked him among those she had all her life counted as the enemy. Martha's socialism was no less ingrained than any inherited faith still clung to past childhood fervour. Community halls and picket lines were her temples, and Annie Besant and Eleanor Marx stood at the altar. She had no hymn book, but the fury of folk songs, setting English suffering to English melody. In the kitchen of their Whitechapel rooms, her father, hands reddened with brick dust, the whorls of his fingertips worn smooth, counted out his wages and set aside his union fees, and in his careful handwriting joined the petitioning of Parliament for a 10-hour limit on the working day. Her mother, who'd once stitched stoles and copes with golden crosses and pelicans pecking out their hearts, cut cloth for banners held high above the picket line and eked out the household budget to take beef soup to the striking match girls at Bryant and May. "All that is solid melts into air," her father had said reverently, reciting his Apostles' Creed. "And all that is holy is profaned. Martha, don't bow your head to the way things are and always were. Whole empires are brought down by nothing but ivy and time." He washed his shirts in the small tin bath. The water came out red. He sang as he wrung the linen dry.
"When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the Englishman?"
When Martha walked from Limehouse to Covent Garden, she saw not high windows and Doric columns, but the labourers toiling behind them. It seemed to her that the city's bricks were red with the blood of its citizens, its mortar pale with the dust of their bones, that deep in its foundations women and children lay head to toe in buried ranks, bearing up the city on their backs. Taking her place in Cora's household had been an act of purest pragmatism. It permitted a degree of social acceptance and reasonable wage. It placed her firmly outside the class she despised and equally firmly within it. But she had not bargained for Cora Seaborn. After all, who could? Spencer's long, melancholy face was flushed. She was conscious of his eagerness to please, and it roused her to mischief.
"All that is solid melts into air," she said, testing his courage.
"Shakespeare?" he said.
Smiling, relenting, Martha said,
"Karl Marx, I'm afraid, though he was a bard of sorts. Yes, there was something I wanted to tell you."
For the sorry truth was that Spencer and those like him, however despised, were useful sources of influence and income. She spread open the pages and showed him a map on which the poorest of London's housing was overlaid with plans for new developments. They would be sanitary, she said, and spacious. Children would have green spaces to play in, and tenants would be free from landlord caprice. But, she flicked contemptuously at the paper, to qualify for housing, tenants must demonstrate good character.
They're expected to live better than you or I ever did, to deserve a roof over their children's heads. Must never be drunk or a nuisance to neighbours, or gamble, and God forbid too many children by too many fathers, and had too often. You, Spencer, with your estate and your pedigree, you can drink yourself wretched on claret and port, and no one begrudges you any of your owns. But spend what little you have on cheap beer and the dogs, and you've not enough moral standing to sleep in a dry bed.
Spencer could not rightly claim to have given the capital's housing crisis any further thought than the headlines invited, and felt keenly the contempt for his wealth and status which lay behind her words. But in her indignation, she seemed to him more to be desired than ever, and as if her rage were contagious, he felt something like anger stir in his belly. He said,
"And if you're given one of these homes, and are later discovered out in the streets, breaking a pint glass over your neighbour's head?"
"On the streets you'll stay, and your children, and it'll be no more than you deserve. We are punishing poverty," she said, pushing away her plate. "If you are poor and miserable, and behave as you might well expect a poor and miserable person to behave, since there's precious little else to pass the time, then your sentence is more misery and more poverty."
He would have liked to ask what he could do, but felt the presence of his privilege as uncomfortably as if it had been pockets full of chilly gold. and instead fumbled with words of agreement and censure. Certainly something ought to be done about it. Questions raised, and so on.
I'm going to do something about it, she said imperiously.
Then, as if to forestall requests for detail, raised her voice and said,
Now, Cora, have you told the imp about your poor Essex parson and the serpent?
Cora, who'd been sitting at Luke's feet, recounting the tale of how she had rescued a lost lamb from the clutches of an Essex ogre, explained how they'd encountered Charles Ambrose and how they'd learned of the beast in the Blackwater shaken loose by the earthquake. She showed him photos of a plesiosaur uncovered at Lyme Regis and gestured to its long tail and its flippers, rather like wings.
Sea dragon, Mary Anning called it. You can see why, can't you? Can't you see why?
She snapped the book shut, triumphant, and told him how she planned to go down to the coast where the Colne and the Blackwater met in their estuary and went out to the sea, and how Charles Ambrose had foisted them on an unsuspecting rural priest and his family. Her friend's appalled laughter threatened to crack in two the black beams that upheld the roof. Mirth doubled him at the waist, and he gestured to her man's boots and the earth beneath her fingernails and the godless little library on the windowsill. The sweet letter of invitation was unfolded and passed from hand to hand, and the primrose crumbled. This Stella Ransom was a darling woman, it was agreed, and ought at all costs to be protected from Cora, who would surely terrify her more than any sea serpent might.
"I hope the good reverend's faith is sincere," he said. "He'll be needing it."
Only Spencer, silently watching from his window seat, saw in Luke's hilarity the unease of a man who would have liked to keep Cora only for himself, with no other friend or confidant, even one choked with a dog-collar and slow-witted to boot. A little later, watching from the window, as Spencer guided his friend the short distance to the George, Martha said,
"I like him. I always thought him stupid. But really, I think he's just kind."
Cora said, "The two things are hard to tell apart sometimes, and sometimes amount to much the same thing. Will you take Francis to his room? I will clear the feathers up, or the maids will think we've held a black mass, and we will lose our reputation." Chapter 2 Stella Ransom stood at the window buttoning her blue dress. It was the view she liked best, taking in the checkered path with its bluebell border, and beyond that the high road with its cluster of cottages and shops, the sturdy All Saints Tower, and the fresh red brick walls of the school. Nothing pleased her more than feeling that all around her was the bustle of life, and she loved the beginning of spring, when green buds quickened on traitor's oak, and the village children were set free from heavy clothes and indoor games. Her usually irrepressible cheer had been dampened by a long winter which had not had the glamour of snow, only been a dreary, chill period that not even Christmas could make bearable. The cough, which had kept her awake at night, had receded as the weather grew warmer, and the grey thumbprints beneath her weary eyes had almost gone. This, too, pleased her. She was not vain, only took delight in her appearance, in just the same way she took delight in the scarlet camellia blooming in its black flower-bed down on the lawn. Her white fair hair, heart-shaped face, and pansy-blue eyes were a pleasant enough sight in the mirror, but one she took for granted. It was true that Will could no longer circle her waist with his outspread hands, but she took to her new stoutness cheerfully. It was evidence of the five children she'd carried, and of the three who remained. She heard them downstairs, ending their early supper, and closing her eyes, saw each as plainly as if she'd gone to the kitchen. James bent over as he drew his fantastic machines, all food disregarded.